Russo, Consolidated. Mr. Ryan.
May it please the court. My name is Andrew Running. I'm counsel for the appellants Keystone and Valhi. I would refer to both appellants as Keystone unless there's a need to be specific. This is an appeal from the grant of summary judgment on four environmental coverage claims by the Central District of Illinois, Judge Mim. Judge Mim, I submit, would not have entered this decision had he had the benefit of this court's November 29th decision in the Sokol case, which we submitted to this court in December. Because the Sokol court looked at the same formulation of Illinois law that Judge Mim did. That is, the theory, or as the Sokol court refers to it, the formula, that where there is no duty to defend, there will be no duty to indemnify. And the Sokol court said that that was a mistake. It was a mistake for the district court in that case to rely on that automatic rule to deny coverage. And the Sokol court proceeded to find an alternative ground for affirmance, but rejected the rationale of the district court. We submit that the same reading in the two cases that were relied on in Sokol by the district court, those two cases, the Common Forester case and the Karras case, were also relied on by Judge Mim. And we think the Sokol...
How much money are we talking about here? Maybe this is in your briefs and disregard, but I know that this Peoria site is the principal one, but what is the relative magnitude of the stakes there and the other three?
You're absolutely right, Judge. The Peoria claim, we've incurred about $5 million in expenses to date. It's a 30-year-plus groundwater remediation program. It may go on forever. And the estimate that we put in the amended complaint is that the total cost to present value will be $11 million. The other claims dwarf in comparison. They're much smaller.
How much smaller?
The Chicago Food and Water claim is approximately $500,000. The impacts claim is approximately $2 million. The Ninth Avenue claim is a little over $1 million.
About $3.5 million.
That's right.
How can you have a $500,000 claim? Don't you need for deductibles?
Your Honor, we've got multiple years of coverage. We have very low deductibles on our coverage policies. $10,000.
Why is that? I mean, it's a corporate. Why would a corporate? There's always a sort of puzzle why corporations even have insurance. But why would it have such a low deductible?
It was obviously a management decision made going back to 1942 to...
Well, it's not illuminated by the record, right?
No, but I would say it was a good decision for Keystone. If you look at any of the policies, the cover sheets, you'll see the premiums were relatively low. So it was a fortunate decision. But there was testimony from the risk manager, not on that question, and it's not...
So now with regard to PR, you can see what the problem is. And we're in a situation where any kind of preventive effort that an insured takes becomes part of the insurance coverage, right? So... you can see this with health insurance. I mean, suppose you have health coverage. There have been articles recently about diabetes epidemic in New York. So suppose you have a situation where you have health insurance that covers your amputations and blindness, all the horrible effects of diabetes. So what you decide to do, because you've read these articles, you're going to get an annual checkup and have a sugar blood test. And that'll actually, stave off these terrible things. But if you're not covered for that health exam, that annual exam, the fact that you may be saving the insurance company money in the long run by this preventive activity doesn't get you coverage. And so isn't that a problem here with Peoria?
No, Judge. The occurrences at issue, that is the leaching of TCE into the groundwater at Peoria, that occurred in the 1960s and 1970s and early 1980s. They do have a defense that I expect to be tried as to whether or not Keystone expected or intended that damage would result from its routine use of TCE, and whether it was a known loss. But those are not summary judgment issues. They weren't presented.
Let me kind of read Judge Posner's concern from a slightly different point of view. I wondered also, if you lost the link between the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify, you would run the risk that people would go out and do too much and assume that it would just be paid for. As long as that duty to defend is in there, the insurance company is in a position to monitor, you know, what's going on, what the compromise might be, how much work is going to be done. And so what I wondered was, what does it take for something to move from the realm of voluntary action into the realm of a quote-unquote claim, such as that word is being used in the umbrella policies and maybe even in some of the other policies? And I also wondered, just on the facts, to what extent was Keystone informing Wausau about the claims? To what extent was it allowing the insurance company to protect its own interest even at the indemnification level, because that's the hazard, really, that the insurance company is running, and that it, of course, has a valid interest in avoiding.
Judge, the Silco Court, the Illinois Supreme Court in 2004, addressed the very question you're asking. In the context of a strict liability statute, such as we're facing here with RCRA and the Illinois Environmental Protection Act, and it noted that in that case, and it's true here as well, it would have been futile for Keystone, in our case, it would have been futile for Keystone to contest its obligations under RCRA to obtain either a post-closure care permit or an enforceable document containing alternative requirements.
In some of these sites, you had formal statements from EPA. You had a record of decision in one of them, and you had, of course, the consent decree that's filed in the Peoria site. In others, it's a little fuzzier. I mean, I can understand by the time you actually have a statement such as existed in Sokol, such as sometimes exists, but you know you're not just off there being, you know, an environmentally friendly person who's deciding to clean up the water, you know. So, but surely there's a need for some clarity there, right?
Obviously, the factual record saying Chicago Steel and Wire is the least developed, I would submit, because WASA didn't raise the proper issues in summary judgment. It was an afterthought. But then we had a notice of violation in 97, and then we had a consultant come in as a part of a sale of the property, did a due diligence review, discovered the MOV, discovered it hadn't been closed, and mm-hmm. had a legal obligation to do the cleanup. Now, that's closer to your concern, Judge. I think on the big claim, Peoria, we're clearly within the scope of the SoCo holding. And I challenge WASA. They've never
raised a consent decree.
There was a consent decree, but as Your Honor is aware, under the ALCO decision, it doesn't matter if you have a consent decree filed the same day as a complaint. The complaint still counts as a suit for purposes of Illinois.
No, I understand. But
and when you look at the consent decree, which I guess was attached to the complaint, so one could legitimately look at the whole thing, even at a pleading stage, it requires remediation of the site as a whole, no matter whether it's this pickle liquor or whatever this stuff is, or the TCEs or whatever it may be.
If it's part of a sale, isn't that an indication that it's voluntary?
Referring to the Chicago Steel and Wire site, certainly the timing
was for your own purposes.
The timing of the due diligence was for purposes of the sale, but there was an MOV outstanding, and it was a matter of time, presumably, before the Illinois EPA acted on it. So it was not of their own choosing in that regard. But with
so would that be the threshold review? If we were making up a rule of law, would we need to see that the authorities had at least gone to the point of issuing a notice of violation?
I think this court doesn't need to do that because the Illinois Supreme Court has already done it in SoCo. They said that there must be a warning from an environmental regulator telling the policyholder that they must either act or face the consequences.
But there's another step, isn't it? Don't you have to prove that you that cleaning up this pollution was the only way you could have complied with the consent decree?
Well, it certainly was limited to comply with the consent decree, Judge, because the consent decree spells out in excruciating detail in five pages that we have in the appendix, pages 29 through 34, all the steps, all the milestones that had to be undertaken to basically put in the pump and treat system, begin its operation.
Okay, if you cross that threshold, then don't you also have to show that the consent decree was not a, elusive settlement of some sort? We have a lot of experience with consent decrees, which are really designed to shift costs to third parties.
Judge, I would say, first of all, Russell did not make that argument below. I presume they'll make it a trial if this is reversed.
But that would be open.
That's the new Adler's clause argument, that we need their consent before entering into a settlement. We cite cases from both this court and Illinois State Court saying that's an issue of fact, that they have to show prejudice.
You're prepared to litigate that, is what you're saying.
Okay, and we put in some, because we were concerned in my ways, and we have some evidence in the record of WASA's policy with respect to these claims. They didn't honor any of them. But in response to Judge Cohen's question, we also rely on the record in our statement of facts, kind of the chronology of discovering the TCE, then the supervision by EPA, the monitoring program that began in November of 1999, and then very importantly, the September 30, 1992 Illinois EPA letter to Keystone, which set forth the additional terms that IEPA was imposing on Keystone as a part of its closure plan approval process. Most of those terms pertain to KF62 spent pickle liquor, but there are critical terms that pertain to groundwater protection standards. And what that letter said, and it was a formal decision by the agency, was that we had to clean up within 10 feet of the impoundments to Class 2 standards. Anything else that is anything deeper than 10 feet had to be cleaned up to Class 1 standards, which are essentially drinking water standards. So the die was cast at that point. I suppose we could have appealed that decision. But then we proceeded to negotiations through the Pollution Control Board process. But that certainly wasn't a voluntary decision on Keystone's part. We were seeking the best possible terms we could have for the closure.
And then, what was your deductible for Peoria?
I'm sure that would be disputed, the policy allocation issues, whether we can pick a coverage year or not. But I generally, the highest deductible, to my knowledge, is $50,000, and I believe...
The relevance of it is the higher your deductible, the less concern the insurance company will have that you're just taking this opportunity to paint your house or something like that. So we have these very low deductibles, so really, shifting the entire cost to the insurance company.
Well, not being part of us, Judge. The initial investigation we weren't seeking recovery of before we gave notice to WASA. And obviously, we've been bearing these $5 million costs since 1993, we've been considerably at risk. But that is ultimately WASA's decision to issue policies with these low deductibles, and I think they should be held to their contractual commitment.
And all we're asking you is that these be remanded for trial, is that right?
Absolutely.
We're not asking for partial summary judgments.
No, we're not. Right? No, they're clearly a fact issue.
You have a three-step prayer at the end. Like, first is remand everything, and then second is
remand
separated out by what kind of an insurance policy is involved.
We believe that it's just a fundamental error. We hope the court doesn't have to reach it, but in treating the umbrella policies identical to the primary policies, if the court didn't follow SOCO and said that they argued about the Crum and Forster language, then we think we still would have a defense under the umbrella policies, because even if you believe that the duty to identify is always circumscribed by the duty to defend, those umbrella policies provide coverage for defense costs for both claims and suits. So therefore, we believe the rule wouldn't even apply to those policies, where most of the coverage is. And then our other fallback is point, our third line of defense is the Peoria claim itself. And that clearly involved a complaint. The only issue is whether that complaint didn't sound out in property damage liability. Judge Moon said it was a mere procedural complaint. And I think, well, there is some service appeal. If you look at the titles of the counts, it doesn't withstand scrutiny. Look particularly at counts 1 and 3. I will concede the other counts do not seek property damage, but particularly count 3. It's critical. Count 1 sets the factual background. and it establishes, most importantly, that the facility operated as a hazardous, operated hazardous waste management units after July of 1982. Therefore, it was subject to RCRA corrective action. It also alleged that the facility did not have a RCRA permit, a hazardous waste management permit. That triggered a whole canopy of corrective action requirements under RCRA, both state and federal. And it's undisputed, and we set them forth in the brief, that if you look at count three, they were seeking injunctive relief requiring that we comply with all of the RCRA regulations, but most particularly the regulation requirements that we have a permit. Now, obviously, we were not using the Title VI to impoundments in 1993. So that what that meant was we needed either a post-closure care permit if we did what was sometimes referred to as dirty closure. That is, if we didn't remove all the contaminants from the site, including the TCE, which is a listed hazardous waste. Or we needed to negotiate an enforceable document, and that's a term referenced in the IPA regulations, particularly 35 Illinois Administrative Code Section 703.121B, one of the regulations citing the complaint. We needed to, if we didn't want to do clean closure, which would have been impossible, would have bankrupted the company, we had to get a post-closure care permit, or we need an enforceable document, and the consent decree was that enforceable document. So I challenge WASA to explain why any of this was voluntary and why any of the 93 complaint did not ultimately require us to clean up that TCE. Thank you.
Now, there's some language in the Silco case that says that you can't recover on a general liability policy.
But the Silco did allow recovery on a general liability policy. So I believe that, and that's why we rely on it so heavily.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Barber.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll address the issues and take up a Keystone's challenge first of all. Looking at the Peoria complaint and the consent decree, there is no duty to defend that complaint or consent decree. It does relate to RCRA violations. If you look at the terms of it, yes, it's true. Under that, they would have to go in and do some cleanup. But remember, going back originally, there was an original RCRA violation complaint in 86 that Judge Mimet handled. Then there was a follow-up complaint in consent decree. This consent decree was for violation, not having a permit, not keeping records. These are not a duty to defend. They didn't create a duty to defend, and Keystone doesn't believe they created a duty to defend.
As I see this consent decree, the analogy that comes to my mind is mission creep. This thing began as it began, and as you're describing, but by the time all is said and done, when you get this consent decree, there are all sorts of specific standards that have to be met that can only be met if you clean up whatever's there, including the TCE. It's not just, we want you to clean up one thing, but you can leave it as dirty as you want with these other things. And so even if historically this is how this thing came to be, by the time you get to the 1993 consent decree, I don't see where Keystone is free to fail to mitigate, as it says, to fail to mitigate groundwater contamination caused by the release of contaminants from the Keystone property. It doesn't just say pickle liquor or other things.
It primarily relates to the KO62.
Well, you say primarily, but the fact is, if this is a consent decree, which I think we can look at as it's attached to the complaint, that requires cleanup of these other items, then that's what it is by 1993.
It is that by 1993. But again, if you look at it, there is no, the words in Silco were the easy way or the hard way. They were simply complying with or attempting to comply improperly with their RCRA permit. They discovered this TCE contamination and had to clean it up.
Well, because there's a consent decree by now with Illinois EPA. And I guess if the issue is whether this is just them being good citizens versus them being required by the state authorities to clean up, it morphs into a requirement by this time. And it doesn't look to me like it could accurately be described, as Judge Moon described it, as simply a bunch of procedural things.
There are primarily procedural aspects. I agree there's a requirement to have...
So is your idea that an insurance claim is a claim that a certain legal theory has been asserted against one, is a claim that one is being... It was a claim that someone is seeking relief for, property damage, even if that's not the theory of liability. The theory of liability might be that you failed to file a piece of paper. And as a result of that, we were making, repair some property damage. So is that your idea, that somehow the theory of the cause of action is what determines insurability?
It's not just the theory, it's the actual cause of action. I don't believe this rises to the level of a claim, because if you look at it, it's related to permit compliance.
So your theory is that if the claim rests on some legal theory, like permit compliance or filing a piece of paper, that's what we're talking about, then the fact that the relief sought is repair of property damage, that doesn't count. You have to look at the theory of the claim. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, you have to look at it and determine, is there a claim? I believe that's exactly what Silco says, that you're merely required to do many things under the law, and many of the things that you're required to do are not insurable costs. The cost of permit compliance, the cost of just general cleanup,
the cost of permit compliance is, paying a fine for the not filing the permit, sure, that's fine. There's no property damage. But if the claimant insists that as a consequence of your failure to get the permit, you have created illegal property damage, why isn't that the sort of thing Keystone wanted insurance against?
Because it's still compliance with RCRA. RCRA requires you to, if you're going to manage hazardous waste, you have to manage them in a certain manner and also promise to keep closure requirements and close it. If you're going to go ahead and manage hazardous waste, you've got to be able to take care of it and be able to close it so it doesn't cause any contamination. That's RCRA permit compliance. That's what this is related to. And that's why Keystone itself did not think this was covered or that there was a duty to defend under the consent decree. There's not. The primary policies clearly limit our defense obligation to only suits. That's all under the primary policies. Under the first umbrella policy, it does contain duty to defend suit language. Again,
what are you saying to me about the duty to defend is a defender of suit? I understand that, but the duty to indemnify in the policy is not defined that narrowly.
No, under the umbrella policies...
Now forget the umbrella policy, under the primary policies.
Under the primary policies, it does relate. It's true, the duty to defend says that we have to defend actions and we have to reimburse. We only have to defend suits under the duty to defend. The duty to indemnify says that we have to defend legal obligations.
It doesn't say defend. Duty to indemnify, not duty to defend. Duty to indemnify.
I don't believe under Lapham Hickey that you can totally break apart those duties.
There are two theories under which one might relate these two duties. And in a series of cases, the Illinois Supreme Court, and actually many other courts, have said if the reason you decide there's no duty to defend is because you have examined the policy and you've examined the allegations of the complaint and they're just too far apart from each other and it doesn't even arguably fall within the terms of the policy, then if the duty to indemnify flows from something being within the policy, if it's not even arguably within the policy, then it's not within the policy and the one is going to follow from the other. You're not going to have a duty to indemnify. But if you write different language, if you have a duty to defend suits, and if you have a duty to indemnify claims or suits, that's not the same situation. That's something where the words of the policy itself have chosen different scopes for the two duties. And I think Keystone's argument is that that's this situation. That for whatever reason, they thought they were buying insurance in this world. We're not very much gets actually reduced to a lawsuit. They thought they were buying protection for claims also.
Under, again, the primary policies, I believe that's answered by the Powerine Court in California.
Well, that's a California case. This is not.
But Silico says that we might agree with Powerine if the policies had a duty to defend. Here, they haven't. All the policies have.
But that's such hypothetical language. The other thing the Illinois Supreme Court has emphasized over and over again is you have to read the policy. You have to look at the language that the parties themselves have chosen.
And I would read that language as you can't break apart the duty to defend and indemnify.
Well, of course you can. Well, I understand you. Of course you can break it apart. How about some common sense? Is there some common sense behind your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. You've got to actually have an actual lawsuit. I believe that's what the policy is.
No. What sense does that make? You want indemnification just against a judgment. Or against a suit, because often you can settle much more advantageously before a suit is filed.
That's true, but you've got to get the insurance company's consent to go ahead before you do that because of the collusive issues. That's why you would have that. You wouldn't want to have
That's a separate point, the duty to notify the insurance company of a claim. That, of course, is a very fundamental part of insurance.
But this would be one case of the notification.
That's a separate issue, the duty to notify.
That's right. That's a separate issue. And
the sensible point is that if someone comes to you with a good claim and says, you know, you owe us $1 million, the answer is, it looks like a good claim, I'll notify the insurance company and so on. Not the answer is, well, you don't have to sue me.
It doesn't say that
under the duty to indemnify.
In the primary, they're linked together.
No. What's the sense of that, right? Does it make any sense that if you come to me with a good claim, I should say to you, sorry, I can't talk to you until you sue me?
If that's what the policies say, yes, that's true. But in certain circumstances, that's exactly what you've got to do.
Why?
Because if you don't have a claim, you put.
No, there's a claim. There isn't a suit.
There's not a suit.
There's a claim.
For instance,
claim is not a suit, right?
That's right. Claim is not a suit.
There's a claim.
That's right.
Now, what's the sense of saying, I have to say to you when you notify me of this claim, you'll have to sue me?
To get coverage, that's what the policy.
What sense does that make?
Because if you have situations where you have insurers going out there, that's exactly the collusive situation and the problem.
It's a notification rule, right? That's why you notify the insurance company.
But you can't look at the policy and break it apart, and that's exactly what happens. That's why it's all.
Then why do you have a notification requirement?
Because you want to get the insurance company involved if they're going to do just that.
But you want to get it involved at the earliest possibility.
That's right.
When the claim is made.
And they have an obligation to notify that. But we don't have an obligation to defend or indemnify that claim because we can limit it by the policy language.
But you didn't.
See, you didn't here. And that's what the Illinois court also said in Silco. It said, when you read this policy, including obviously the policy with some differences to this one, but when you read this policy, if the insurance industry does not want to write policies with a duty to indemnify that's separable from a duty to defend, it can rewrite the policies. But the one there happened only to have a duty to indemnify, not a duty to defend. And the one here uses significantly different language in the scope of the duty to indemnify versus the duty to defend. And people can write what they want to write. You can go off and revise all your policies tomorrow if you want to.
You know, all the problems arise when you go into environmental problems. And these policies originally were not written to address environmental problems, were they? Property damage policies, right?
That's right. And they were not written to address that. That's absolutely true. And many of these costs are costs of doing business that they're seeking to just basically have insurance companies pay for when these were never intended to be contracted for. Under SILCO, the differences between the SILCO languages are critical. And I think SILCO said that. SILCO said, we have policies that have no defense obligation. Duty to defend is not an issue. That is clearly an issue here. Absolutely in the primary policies, in the first umbrella policies, all the policies here have
right, but all that means is that there's a question of contract interpretation in front of the court, which is to decide how, if at all, the duty to defend affects the duty to indemnify or vice versa. It doesn't mean they can't be separate. It doesn't mean they must be linked. There's just an interpretation issue.
That's right. And in some cases, the duty to defend can be read with the duty to indemnify. And I would argue that Slapham Hickey, the Fruit of the Loom case, and SILCO is a case where you would mandate that you do that, because there you did not even have duty to defend obligations. Sokol says that if the duty to defend nested inside the indemnity, I believe that was the word used, or Sokol uses the word correlative, then you have to read them together. And I think you have to read these policies together to make that determination. And I think that's how you would read
them. Well, you may have given a reason why they should be read together in your way. It is why on earth an insured would want the kind of insurance you described doesn't make any sense.
Well, but that's what they agreed to, because certain costs they would incur, and these are costs to businesses. There are certain costs we simply would not have an obligation to pay, and that's what Lapham Hickey, and that's what the Illinois court said.
If you're looking between the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify, I assume in the pre-environmental era that was standard. That one was a territory, but when we get into the environmental problems, this is when we have all these difficulties of interpretation, is that?
And you have different regulatory schemes. Here, RCRA at the Peoria site, for two of these claims, they are not claims, and that's, I believe, definitely true for the impact site. That's the Crawfordsville site. There's nothing, nor is there anything at the Chicago Wire and Steel site.
Yes, it would make perfectly good sense to confine a duty to defend to suits, right? Because there isn't much to defend before you're sued, right? And yet, it would be perfectly sensible to say, well, the duty to indemnify is broader because it's often desirable to settle a case before suit.
But the courts have construed them differently, as the duty to defend is much broader, the duty to indemnify.
The duty to defend is broader in a totally irrelevant sense. The duty to defend is broader because you can have a situation because the defendant prevails, there's no, in the underlying liability suit, there's no indemnification, there's zero indemnification. But, of course, there's still a duty to defend. So that's the sense in which the duty to defend is broader. They defend against suits which, because they have no merit, they don't result in any indemnification.
That's right, but you still have to have a claim, a third party seeking, not simply a statute that may require you to do it, to trigger either the duty to defend or the duty to defend.
A claim, yes, not a suit. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Barber. So your time has expired, Mr. Barber. So we'll move on to our next case.